Welcome to Reclaiming the Republic. This show is sponsored by ReclaimingTheRepublic.org. I am G.R. Mobley. This is an educational grassroots program focused on uniting and leading in restoring the Republic and placing the federal government back into the scope and framework of the Constitution once again. And welcome back, and it is now or never, and that debt is fraud, and it's all about full compliance to the Constitution. This is why we hope that you find candidates that will be willing to run as champions of the Constitution and willing to run to be held accountable. I think you can swing a bat with a blindfold in a mosh pit and hit anybody. You just swing the bat and hit somebody that would be happy to take advantage of you. Finding a person that is willing to actually go and function within the limited powers of government, that takes a special person these days. We seem to be swimming in a sea of moral turpitude amongst our fellow man, amongst our fellow citizens. We must start changing the paradigm. It's all about accountability. We have all of the power to do this, folks. It starts with us. We have to demand it. When we start demanding it, then maybe even we will start saying, you know what, I shouldn't be taking this money because they don't have any authority to do this, and they're taking from everybody else, which is theft. They're just like when they take money from me and give it to somebody else. We have to stop being the hypocrites. We have to stop being the problem if we want to save liberty. That's the real question. And so this is why I ask you to support Jerry Wistrand out of Missouri, who is actually a champion of the Constitution, wanting to be held accountable. Therefore, welcome back, Sean. And with...
Great year, sir.
Thank you. And with your return, we were covering the South Carolina debates where they just started talking about the differences between the state governments. Now, so far, we've read a few different debt ratification debates. Not one of them has ever stated that, hey, these other governments are going to have to change. It's kind of like, oh, well, we seem to be the model government that the federal government wants to kind of model all the rest of the governments after us. There's no language at all regarding model governments, changing governments, the federal government having the authority to change their form of government. In other words, folks, they're very clear about talking about how different the states are, how problematic that may be when it comes to the federal government trying to function in interfacing with them when it comes to justice, with the judiciary, when it comes to the laws themselves, which is why they were limited to only creating laws that would directly affect all of the states. The federal government cannot create laws that affect a few of the states because of their form of government or so forth and so on. In other words, the concept of self-determination was the foundation of governments under the Declaration of Independence. Now, we're just a day away from reading Thomas Jefferson's original draft on the Declaration of Independence. Now, I've been doing this. I've been reading his draft since I've been on the radio. And so, you know, when I started with my own show, I started reading his original draft back in 2017, because my first radio show broadcast was on September 17th, 2016. That was my first broadcast. Now, I'd been on other shows and worked with and had guest hosting, that type of thing, going back to 2013. But the fact is that I've always given you the original documents so that you can see for yourself. So tomorrow we're going to read the Declaration of Independence, Thomas Jefferson's original draft, so you can see for yourself how the picture that was being painted was not favorable towards slavery or those types of things that were being inflicted upon the states. We've already read for you the Articles of Association. In the Articles of Association, the states clearly stepped up and said, hey, look, we do not like this slavery, and we're not taking on any more slaves. All of the states signed off on the Articles of Association. The Declaration of Independence precedes the Articles of Confederation. This is the one document we have not read chronologically because we're already well past that. I have not taken the time, but I'm going to today, and I will tomorrow, because the concept of self-determination regarding our governments is the foundation of this hybrid constitutional republic. As long as you're Republican in form, and as long as your government, that you stand up from county to state and so forth, does not conflict with the United States Constitution. In other words, you're not making laws that allow anything other than gold and silver coin to be the legal tender for the payment of debt. You're not making any other laws that abridge your privileges and immunities as citizens, so forth and so on and so on and so on. Then you're okay. You can govern yourself the way you are. There's not a lot of things that the U.S. Constitution necessarily requires. The biggest and broadest thing is that no state or any government within that state can abridge the privileges and immunities of any U.S. citizen, period. They cannot make or enforce any law that does so. Therefore, that's kind of like the big one. And that we find in the 14th Amendment. So the self-determination is you can kind of do what you want as long as you're not abridging privileges and immunities of U.S. citizens. So going through the South Carolina debates, we just hit this yesterday where they started talking about the differences of the states. Now, they're actually going to go into Charles Pinckney, not General Pinckney, but Charles Pinckney, is going to go into a little discourse on not only the differences of government, but he's going to cover kind of sovereignty, what sovereignty of government is, and the form of government, and so forth. So I'm really looking forward to this, because I want you to understand, folks, the federal government has no authority whatsoever to dictate to your state what your counties are doing or how you're forming your state legislature at all. They don't have any authority arising under that Constitution to ensure that everybody's vote is equal. They have no authority at all to get involved in the elections other than Congress having the responsibility and authority to ensure that every person that's being elected into the House of Representatives and into the electors, as well as the Senate, are being done so constitutionally to understand that they've been legitimately done. I will tell you right now that I don't know how long or if there ever was a inspection on the Electoral College by Congress. They have the responsibility to do it. And as a matter of fact, since 1856, the states have absolutely obviated, they've obfuscated the whole process, and they are no longer following the process of the people choosing their electors. I kind of talked about this before, Sean, where the federal government has not really clarified the Electoral College. When it came down to the Constitution, when they left the convention, they thought, because it was stated, that the people were the ones to choose their electors. But when they went back and they ratified this and went through the individual conventions, and even though in the ratification debates it even stated that the people were to choose their electors, state legislatures started dictating who their electors were going to be. They thought that it was within their power. Clearly, the Constitution says that the state legislature shall, and let me pull it up, because these things are important, right? The language of this stuff. So let me pull up my handy-dandy color-coded Constitution. And if I look at Article 1 or Article 2, Section 1, it says this: each state shall appoint this each, so each state meaning each state legislature shall appoint in such manner as the legislature may direct a number of electors equal to the whole number of the senators, representatives to which the state may be entitled in the Congress, but no senator or representative or person holding an office of trust or profit under the United States shall be appointed an elector. And so that's what it grants to them, that they shall appoint in such manner. That was kind of perceived in the very beginning as this process. Oh, well, we can dictate the outcome, not the manner. And so when we get to the 12th Amendment, the 12th Amendment kind of changes this language a little bit. And it basically just says the electors shall meet in each state, but it doesn't say anything more about that's the 12th Amendment. Yeah, so it doesn't. Let me go back to the Article 1, Section 1, Article 2, Section 1, Article 2, Section 1, and it changes the second paragraph. So everything of that first paragraph. Each state legislature shall appoint in such a manner as the legislature may or thereof may direct. Now, when we go into the actual election process, it says that the state legislature, the times, place, and manner of holding elections for senators, representatives shall be prescribed. So this kind of also handles the election process, not the electors, but the election process of themselves. The electors are to be the ones that choose the president. So they have the authority to actually dictate the time, place, and manner of the elections, not necessarily the outcome. This is one of the reasons why it was dictated. And it, again, like I said, it's ambiguous in both Article 1, Section 2, or actually, I thought it was in the 12th Amendment. But in Article 1, Section 1, or Article 2, Section 1, it's ambiguous as to what that means by they shall appoint in such manner. It was defined in the ratification debates that the people would choose their electors, that the state legislature would not be the ones appointing it. However, for the entirety of its existence, South Carolina, up until 1856, appointed their electors. And so nobody went after them. Nobody sued them or anything like that. There was no lawsuit going after the electors. The point I'm trying to make here is that when we look at this responsibility that the state legislatures have, they were never granted the ability to choose the outcome of who would choose the president, who would choose or who was going to be the choosers of the president, and who was going to be your representatives. If you think about it, it would almost be the same thing as your state legislature dictating out of all the candidates or the people who want to be representatives, saying, you will be the representative of this district, you will be the representative of this district, and you're going to be the elector for that congressional district, you're going to be the elector for that congressional district. To be clear, we're supposed to have self-determination, and the one thing, the one group of people that we are to directly elect are our representatives. Our elector is our representative in choosing the president, and our congressional representative is the one that represents us in legislation of Congress. So as we kind of look at this whole process, that's about it as far as what we're supposed to be involved in. Our form of government is self-determined by how we frame our state constitutions and our county constitutions. But again, there's no language, back to the self-determination, there's no language at all for the federal government to be involved in anything other than the outcome of the elections to ensure that the people were properly elected, that only U.S. citizens voted, those types of things, to ensure that there wasn't any improper selection or election of somebody. Now, I don't want to belabor the point. Let's dive into how they go through this concept of self-governing, the differences of government. We're still not done with that. And what these differences kind of are, and clearly identify this Republican form of government, i.e. our sovereigns, and so forth and so on. So, Sean, why don't we go ahead and pick up with that second paragraph that we didn't finish off with. Go ahead.
In Massachusetts, we find the principle of legislation more improved by the revisionary power which is given to their governor and the independence of their judges. In New York, the same improvement in legislation has taken place as in Massachusetts. But here, from the executives being elected by the great body of the people, holding his office for 3 years, and being re-eligible from the appointment to offices being taken from the legislature and placed in a select council. I think their constitution is, upon the whole, the best in the union. Its faults are the want of permanent salary to their judges and giving to their executive the nomination to offices, which is, in fact, giving him the appointment.
So in other words, in some ways, he's kind of pointing out that some of the framework that they used in the federal constitution by salaries and permanent appointments and so forth, they followed New York and Massachusetts. But let's go down a little bit further where they talk a little bit about sovereignty now.
In every government, there would necessarily exist a power from which there is no appeal, and which for that reason may be formed absolute and uncontrollable. The person or assembly in whom this power resides is called the sovereign or supreme power of the state.
Okay, so right there, when we talk about this, it is the person that actually has, or group, that actually has the full power of the creation of law, the full power of taxation, the full power of being able to inflict and govern the people. Who is that? What would that be in our three branches of government? Is that the president? Does the president have the ability to create law?
No, sir.
Same thing with the court. So what they're talking about is the supreme sovereign. So you've heard me say this before, right, Sean? Where I've explained that in our Republican form of government, they are literally our sovereigns, because when we've created this government and we delegated these very specific powers, that gave them sovereignty over those few powers we delegated. We didn't give them full, unlimited power. We gave them limited and defined power over these objects and only those objects, right?
Correct.
Okay. So now we kind of understand, because here's this will come up in Virginia too, where they talk a bit about sovereignty. But I just want to help you understand, folks, our representative government is not representation of the people. It's representation of where the sovereignty resides. And if we've given limited power to our county government, right now we've given no power to our county government. So our county government has no sovereignty at all. But we've given limited power to our state government. We can change that by actually creating county constitutions and then going back and changing the state constitution so that we can distribute the power more appropriately. See, this is the beautiful thing about our system. This is the beautiful thing about the Declaration of Independence. It allows us to alter, abolish, and or institute new. We don't need to institute a new state. We just need to alter it. But we do need to institute our county government for the first time. And in so doing, we can create a constitution and delegate them the power that we want them to have, and then create general powers, or I should say very limited powers, for the state government to function as a general government. In other words, not being able to get in our knickers, but more of a support role to ensure that the counties can do what we want them to do. Like the federal government, or I should say the national general government that services and supports the states. And it does very specific things that the states don't do, like go to war, deal with foreign trade, that type of stuff. So anyway, let's get into the forms of government too, because I find this very illuminating in helping people understand the different forms of government. So go ahead.
Can I ask why you didn't highlight with us the sovereignty of the union is in the people?
Well, because in that, in the union itself, that would equate to almost a democracy. It is tiered. Technically, he's kind of marginalizing, because we do have sovereignty in the union in the House of Representatives, but the states have sovereignty in the union in the Senate. See my point? So it's not a single sovereignty in the people. It is a tiered sovereignty where we are full sovereigns over the county government. We share sovereignty at the state level if we actually institute a bicameral. If we follow the federal template, then we would share the sovereignty with our county government, because the county would basically be appointing those people that would sit in the Senate. And we would be selecting the person that represents us for our county. We would, if we followed this model, we should be, and this is what we should be doing, if you ask me, then that's why. So if you just gloss it over, this goes back to James Wilson, always talking about the powers of the people, the powers of the people. Yeah, sure. We do have the power of forming a county government and then selecting who's going to govern us. Sure. But once we've done that, going to the next level, we should actually ensure they have representation at the state government, because we've delegated them power. If not, we could undermine our own counties. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir.
Okay. All right. That's why. That's why I didn't highlight that. But that's a good question. Good question. I'm sure somebody else would have read that and gone, you know, Hackney didn't do that. Okay. Let's go ahead. The forms of government now.
One of the best political and moral writers, Pellet, a deacon of Carlisle, volume 2, 174 and 175, enumerates three principal forms of government, which he says are to be regarded as the simple forms, by some combination and intermixture of which all actual governments are composed, than as anywhere existing in a pure and elementary state. These forms are, first, despotism, or absolute monarchy, where the legislature is in a single person. Second, an aristocracy, where the legislature is a selected assembly, the members of which either fill up by election the vacancies in their own body, or succeed to it by inheritance, property, tenure of lands, or in respect of some personal right or qualification. Third, a republic, where the people at large, either collectively or by representation, form the legislature. The separate advantages of monarchy are unity of counsel, decision, secrecy, and dispatch. The military strength and energy resulting from these qualities of government, the exclusion of popular and aristocratical contentions, the preventing by a known rule of succession, all competition for the supreme power, thereby repressing dangerous hopes and intrigues of aspiring citizens. The dangers of a monarchy are tyranny, expense, exactions, military dominations, unnecessary wars, ignorance in the governors of the interests and accommodation of all people, and a consequent deficiency of salutary regulations, want of constancy and uniformity in the rules of government, and proceeding from thence, insecurity of persons and property. The separate advantage of an aristocracy is the wisdom that may be expected from experience and education. A permanent council naturally possesses experience, and the members will always be educated with a view to the stations they are destined by their birth to occupy. The mischiefs of an aristocracy are dissensions in the ruling orders of the state, an oppression of the lower orders by the privilege of the higher, and bylaws partial to the separate interests of the lawmakers.
Okay, so right there, let's just pause, because we're going into a promo. I didn't realize, I wasn't watching that, I would have hit you up before that last paragraph. So these are short little paragraphs, folks, but when we come back, we can pick this up where we left off, because this is a good description in a general form based on the maturity of understanding the government in our Constitution. We'll be right back after this. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review as well as my description of the Republic Review model on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how Republic Review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you. As a reminder, if you have any questions or comments, we have a 24-hour comment line, 425-270-5416. Okay, so before you go back, and let's just start off again with the mischiefs of an aristocracy. Let me just say this, that these men had not had had any time to chew, digest this new form of government that they were basically blessed with. And so they never could understand this multi-tiered, multifaceted Republican form of government. And so it's something that, again, this is why I use metaphors like the human body or the complexities of a body with multiple functions that are capable of doing things independently as well as in conjunction with and harmonious with. And so they're basically giving you a snapshot of government and the paradigm of government back at the beginning of this epoch. Not seeing and not knowing, because I'm telling you, and I'm, you know, Sean, I don't want to just basically say that, you know, what I'm saying is, you know, I'm trying not to pat myself on the back. I don't know of anybody that's done this or stated these things in this way, but I will say this, that it seems like the framers missed this. And I think the one person that I saw talking about, you know, the beauty and the some of the functions and these independent, you know, complexities and so forth came from Madison. I don't see anybody, everybody else kind of just marginalized, this is what that does. And they just simplified it. They didn't want to, you know, spend a lot of time thinking about, wow, you know, we have this system that could actually be, you know, just unlimited. You know, as long as the federal government stayed in check, these states could really take off and become huge economies. And as long as the states kind of stayed in check, that the counties could really thrive. Instead of just allowing the certain things and the I'll just call it the paradigms or the status quo. I mean, because why is it that commerce only thrives along the coastlines? Why is it that commerce can't thrive, you know, in the middle of the nation? Why can't it thrive, you know, in where the agriculture is and so forth, or where the minerals are, where the resources are? Well, I can understand that for the longest time, the world trade was really dependent upon water. The best way to move commerce was by boat, period. Because once you got, you know, a whole bunch of weight on a little, you know, raft or what have you, you could move more with less effort. Once you broke inertia, then continuing to move it using wind and other things became very easy. Where if you're putting it in a wagon or in a trailer or a railroad, it requires constant energy. So I can understand how the coastline became, you know, the primary mechanism of importation and exportation, especially externally. And even when you looked at the trade among the states, they would basically go, shoot, I'll give you an example. When Thomas Jefferson left office, he didn't put everything into his wagons and go to Monticello. He actually put everything in boats that went down the Potomac, down to Norfolk. Then it went into wagons to go up to Monticello. They used the, you know, the shortest routes possible on the road, and they used as much sea or water traffic because of the ease of moving commerce or moving goods. That makes sense, right?
Absolutely.
Okay, so we've matured. We've been able to do a lot more, but the expense or the cost of energy has always been the drag. Well, we all know, and I mean, I hate to throw out the conspiracy, but and I'm in a rat hole and I'm swimming here. We all understand that there is deals that are being done with government to basically create favors and favoritism, and petroleum and fossil fuel was something that was protected for a long time. They didn't allow efficiencies and those types of things, because we've even seen documentation like Tucker in the creation of a more efficient engine. And we've heard other cases where the petroleum and the car manufacturers have kind of been in cahoots to ensure that their cars are going to consume, you know, a certain amount of petroleum, because the last thing they want is to, you know, slow down the consumption, because they became dependent on having that amount of money. It's almost like when I had employees working for me, still swimming in this hole, and we had a huge need for working overtime. And all the employees that were working overtime, I kind of warned them. I said, look, you believe that you have a salary that's coming in, but you have to understand that some of that money is coming because you have overtime. When the overtime goes away, you're going to see a drop in your income. Doesn't mean you're really making less money. You're just not working overtime anymore, and you're not being compensated for that. So be very careful with how you budget your money, because you can easily find yourself after 2-3 years of making overtime, you think, well, I'm making all this money. You're really not. And so they put themselves into harm's way. And next thing you know, their overtime goes away. They can't cover all of their bills. And now they have financial problems. This is how life is. As you know, new things come forward, petroleum, they start making more money, and they get used to making that money. They want to keep making that money, and they want to make more. And nobody wants to see their revenue drop and so forth. So they create and collude to maintain these things. This is constantly being done in all different industries, in tech industries, fuel, energy industries, so forth and so on. So the bottom line
is pharmaceutical.
Bottom line is that they're only successful in these types of collusions because government protects them. But the reality is, if we were actually had a true free market where we weren't being regulated, where government couldn't come along and say, you can't make a car like that. You can't create that kind of energy. You can't do those things. Because we have a government that actually does that. They tell us we can't do those things. You can't do this. You can't do this. You have to stay within the status quo so that everybody that, you know, is controlling us is happy with the money that they're making. It's basically this huge conspiracy. And I know I'm swimming in this. But bottom line, as we look at, you know, this republic and what we could be doing if we were truly free and we were able to make all sorts of different, I'll just say, energies and solutions to solve the problems, I'm going to guess that the people of the interior would have came up with real solutions of moving their products better instead of allowing government to stifle, you know, any and all innovations. To say, well, why even go there? They won't let us do that. So as we kind of look at America and this tiered government system, the federal government started imposing and overreaching, regulating us with energy, regulating us with labor, regulating us with all these different things to stifle us. My point is that these men didn't understand that if they wouldn't have, you know, overreached, if they would have done these things over the course of the last 250 years, we would be in a completely different circumstance and the world would be in completely different circumstances. We succumbed to the, you know, I'll just call it mammon. We decided to start serving mammon instead of, you know, humanity's interests. Because I believe enlightenment and innovation and those types of things, the sky was the limit. And we would have been well beyond that, well beyond that. So the only way we can actually get to where our real potential is we have to get back into this framework of this multi-tiered government to allow the counties to do as much as they possibly can to innovate how they're going to move. Because government's job is not to keep you from, you know, taking this much time to get from your home to your work. Government's job is just to, you know, make sure that you have the services that you've empowered them to do, if you give them any. And yet we seem to have government that's putting in roundabouts to slow you down. Government is doing more to reduce our productivity and to basically, you know, keep us contained. Why? Because it serves the greater cause. If we are going unchecked, then this, again, we would reach limits that we could not even imagine. So as we're going through this, he's talking about government. This is the paradigm that they had. And unfortunately, this has been a paradigm that has been maintained for years. I'm right here breaking the paradigm. I hope that there's other people. I don't know of anybody. But I'm praying that there are other people that are thinking and well have thought beyond this. I'm hoping somebody can, you know, come up with, look at these other people 40 years ago that were talking about exactly what you're talking about. Because the old saying, great minds think alike. And I'm not saying I've got a great mind, but I am here to tell you that this is not necessarily original, even though it may be, there could be something out there. I would like to think that other people had come up with these ideas. Other people had seen these things and said, wow, look at what we could really be doing. But the fact is, we have been given a system that's a multi-tiered government that's not to be controlled from the, you know, the federal level or the state level. We're to be controlling ourselves at the county level. This way, well, why not drive 500 miles an hour if we could make a vehicle, you know, and put it on a string or travel in pneumatic, pneumatic tubes or, you know, it's, you know what I'm talking about? Like they have at Costco or these big places, they put money in a tube and it goes to the destination.
Right. Like at the bank, at the drive-thru.
Correct. You know, why haven't we done things like that, that, you know, can very efficiently and quickly move a lot of stuff? Whoosh. Anyway, my point is that what we're hearing and what he's giving us is a paradigm of government that was, you know, a reality for them. I'm here to let you know that this is a good general description, but what we have is far greater. Go ahead. You left off with the mischiefs of an aristocracy. Go ahead.
The mischiefs of an aristocracy are dissensions in the ruling orders of the state, an oppression of the lower orders by privilege of the higher, and by laws partial to the separate interests of the lawmakers. The advantages of a republic are liberty, exemption from needless restrictions, equal laws, public spirit, averseness to war, frugality, above all, the opportunities afforded to men of every description of producing their abilities and counsels to public observation, and the exciting to the service of the commonwealth the faculties of its best citizens. The evils of a republic are dissensions, tumults, faction, the attempts of ambitious citizens to possess power, the confusion and clamor which are the inevitable consequences of propounding questions of state to the discussion of large popular assemblies, the delay in disclosure of the public councils, and too often the imbecility of the laws. A mixed government is composed by the combination of two or more of the simple forms above described, in whatever proportion each form enters into the constitution of government, in the same proportion may both the advantages and evils which have been attributed to that form be expected.
Now, I'm here to tell you that this mixed government is as equally problematic as the other governments that you have. When you really look at what he talks about for a republic, That, and as you look at all of these things, the concept of these governments is the government has full power. There's nowhere here where he limits or he even talks about, you know, creating a republic that can only do these very minute things, and that everything is left to this lower government and the people, and that they can only do these minute things, and everything else that is left is to the lower government and the people, and then that they can only do these things, and that the rest is left to the lower government and the people, or, and then, you know, they can only do these things, and then everything else is left to the people. If you understand what I just said, then now you can start grasping why and how we need to place checks and hold everybody accountable, the powers granted. I got a comment, and I'm just, forgive me for going down another rat hole, but I received a comment from a friend, a constitutionalist and a Republican out of Wyoming that received this diatribe out of a state legislator. And this diatribe basically says, hey, we can, you know, we can tax your property, we can take your property, and these things are, you know, a part of government, have been, you know, a part of government all the way back to Rome and all these other things. And I go, you know, so this person said, you know, how would you respond to this? And I go, well, easy. Whoever wrote that is completely illiterate on our Constitution, because there's no power granted in the federal Constitution for them to be able to, you know, take our property. And as a matter of fact, there's specific protections in the Fifth Amendment and Seventh Amendment that protects us to ensure that we will be justly served if government has to take our property. At the state level, I'm not aware of any state that has the power to be able to do those things where it's actually in their state constitution, because the state constitutions are really feebly done. The real problem isn't the fact that this person believes all of this. The real problem is the fact that they believe they can spend money on anything and everything they want. And taxation is the effect from the cause being spending. They can't just spend money on everything. They can only tax for those things that they legitimately can do. And so we need to really start helping people understand this, these limited and defined constitutions. And if you find that your constitution's got some holes in it, or you know, is not really containing the government the way it should be, then shoot, go back and change it so that you can confine them more. The more you can confine, this is the whole point of why Madison made the comments regarding if men were angels, government would not be needed. But because men aren't angels, then we need government. And if, you know, our government was angels, or I should say, there's this other, I mean, if you read that, this is in Federalist Paper 10. And if you read that little diatribe, I mean, it's very profound, because the reality is this is why we create governments with checks, and we want as many checks as possible. The better you can have checks and balances, the better your government's going to be. This is why our government, bar none, is superior to all governments that have ever been formed on this rock circling around that bright star we call our sun. Period. Period. So let's dive down to, unless you got any comments on that. Probably you do, but anyway.
14th Amendment, Section 1. No state shall make or enforce any law which shall abridge the privileges and immunities of citizens of the United States, nor shall any state deprive any person of life, liberty, or property without due process of law.
Right. So that right there creates a check, that no state government can abridge the privileges and immunities of a U.S. citizen, which means that all of these inalienable rights, because remember, the Ninth Amendment basically says, and if you read the, go ahead, since you got it there in front of you, read the Ninth Amendment. The Ninth Amendment is the catch-all. It says something about no enumeration in the Constitution be construed as...
Enumeration in the Constitution of certain rights shall not be construed to deny or disparage others retained by the people.
So in other words, even though you may have listed it in the Constitution to give government this right, such as, you know, we're going to regulate, you know, child labor, that doesn't mean that that can take away parental rights. That doesn't mean that, you know, in health, it doesn't mean that they can take away your parental rights. Those things cannot deny you those fundamental rights. And so we see governments actually creating in the state level amendments, or I should say empowering themselves with the power over your family. That is,
I think that goes straight to the abortion argument. I mean, I hate to go down that rat hole, but just because you have a right to privacy, it doesn't give you the right to kill another human being.
And so states could, if so, bottom line is what ended up happening is the Supreme Court, because everybody had been bamboozled to say, oh, they are the supreme arbiters. They say what they say goes. So everybody bought into it. Everybody's been buying into the lies from the federal courts for well over a century. As they've redefined things unconstitutionally, they've made these unconstitutional edicts. And so what happened when they basically said that a woman does have a right to go kill their child? That just choked everything. And now we've got a paradigm that we have to break. Yes, you can make abortions illegal. And you can actually, if you go down that path, you can make the citizens of your county accountable for a crime. If the woman goes, if you want to say, if you get an abortion, you've killed your child, and we will hold you accountable for that. Well, then, you know, if you want to get an abortion, the first thing you get better do is not just go get an abortion, you better move. Because if not, you'll be a criminal in that county. See my point?
Absolutely.
So the way I look at this, because as we start understanding with Christianity and so forth, when the punishment for adultery was to be stoned, and when Christ, you know, came across the adulterer and, you know, the party that, you know, was about to commence, that, you know, Christ, they asked him, you know, the law says we do this. And he says, well, he among you who have without sin cast the first stone. And then everybody dispersed. And then he basically says, where are your accusers? So this concept that we need to somehow embrace and enfold into our society called repentance and forgiveness is another thing that is a challenge for this new enlightened society that we've been blessed with, and how to do that. I'm not here to solve all the problems, folks. I'm only here to basically help you understand how this Constitution was defined and how this concept of self-determination has been a blessing bestowed upon us from on high. So let's go into, unless you got another one to follow up.
No, that would be the ultimate rat hole. So let's keep going.
Thank you. Okay, so gold, see, I tried to leave it at that. Because, you know, how do we solve all these problems? Well, we first have to solve the basic problems that we haven't solved yet. And then I think that, you know, step by step, line by line, precept upon precept, we can get closer and closer to a more divine order. Does that make sense?
Oh, absolutely.
Okay.
Yes.
There, so let's fix the problems that we've created for ourselves by screwing up our hybrid constitutional republic. And so the first one that we're going to go into is gold money. Go ahead.
I apprehend these general reasons will be found true with respect to paper money, that experience has shown that in every state where it has been practiced since the Revolution, it always carries the gold and silver out of the country and impoverishes it, that while it remains, all the foreign merchants trading in America must suffer and lose by it, therefore that it must ever be a discouragement to commerce, that every medium of trade should have an intrinsic value, which paper money has not. Gold and silver are therefore the fittest for this medium, as they are an equivalent, which paper can never be. That debtors in the assemblies will, whenever they can, make paper money with fraudulent views. That in those states where the credit of the paper money has been best supported, the bills have never kept to their normal value in circulation, but have constantly depreciated to a certain degree. I consider it as a granted position that while the productions of a state are useful to other countries and can find a ready sale at foreign markets, there can be no doubt of their always being able to command a sufficient sum in specie to answer as a medium for the purpose of carrying on this commerce, provided there is no paper money or other means of conducting it.
Ah, okay, but that's not where he landed. He also stated regarding the second comment on gold and money. But above all,
how much will this section tend to restore your credit with foreigners, to rescue your national character from that contempt which must ever follow the most flagrant violations of public faith and private honesty? No more shall paper money, no more shall tender laws, drive their commerce from our shores and darken the American name in every country where it is known. No more shall our citizens conceal in their coffers those treasures which the weakness and dishonesty of our government have long hidden from the public eye. The firmness of a just and even system shall bring them into circulation, and honor the virtue shall be again known and countenanced among us. No more shall the widow, the orphan, and the stranger become the miserable victims of unjust rulers. Your government shall now indeed be a government of laws.
Okay, so that, believe it or not, folks, there wasn't much other than, I'd highly recommend you read all of these orations and so forth that are in this, in these debates. But the final comment that we've highlighted, or that I've highlighted, is the speech of Mr. Patrick Dollard. And it's, let me see here, it's the whole speech. I don't have it highlighted, but it's the whole speech. And so we only have 50 seconds. So when we come back, not tomorrow, because tomorrow we're going to be going through the original draft of the Declaration. We'll go back and we'll read this right here to speak of what Mr. Dollard stated in the closing of this debate on the Constitution in South Carolina. Then we will go into the next state, and I'm trying to remember, what is that next state? Do you remember what that next state is?
No, sir.
Well, then let me look at my handy-dandy cheat sheet. It's going to be Virginia. So the only two states we have left to do is Virginia and North Carolina. So Virginia being the big meaty one, North Carolina is pretty meaty too, but Virginia will probably take a few weeks. So we might be wrapping up the ratification debates by sometime in August, hopefully, by the end of August. That way we can start speeding through many of the different acts and so forth, and then get into the Constitution, and then get back to the rest of these acts, kind of going back into the chronological order of the Constitution and so forth. So anyway, folks, I'm doing everything I can to try to cover all of the bases chronologically, other than these events that I like to tie to, i.e. the 4th of July, which is going to be tomorrow, and then Constitution Day, we read the entire Constitution, so forth and so on. And, you know, I'm going to talk to Sean whether we should do that or not. I'm G.R. Mobley. We're Reclaiming the Republic, and we need your help. God bless. If you've listened to my show, Reclaiming the Republic, then you should understand that the Constitution is neither a living document nor a noble guide to governance. In accordance to Article 7, the Constitution is a hard, fast contract, and the states are the only stakeholders in this contract. Integral in contract law, the stakeholders or states possess the inherent authority to exercise oversight and enforcement over their contract. This means they can audit the federal government by the contract, and with republic review, they can enforce compliance to their constitution. Any single state can perform the audit, but when states begin to unite in the auditing process, this is what is referred to as republic review. Please read my argument for republic review, as well as my description of the republic review model, on reclaimingtherepublic.org. We even have a graphic flowchart that shows you how republic review works. If you want to learn more, contact me on Facebook or send me an email. Thank you.